Thank you so much for the introduction and for having me here. It's an absolute delight to be speaking to you all today. And I did see when the recording started, my little green outline vanished. Can you all still see my screen? Is it still shared?
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Great. So yeah, as you heard, I'm going to be talking to you about spin signatures and VLBI images of supermassive black hole accretion flows. Along the way today, I guess before you leave this room, I hope you understand a little bit about how the Event Horizon Telescope works and sort of puts constraints on these accretion flows. But mostly, I hope you know a great deal about how we look at and interpret the images that we see in the context of both simulations and simple physical arguments about accretion flows around supermassive black holes. So without further ado, the Event Horizon Telescope is a global network of both radio observatories and people that's been decades in the making and is now nearly 400 people strong, largely consisting of repurposed or refurbished telescopes that are in places with good enough weather to observe at 230 gigahertz, which is the EHT observing frequency targeting synchrotron radiation from mostly Messier 87 and Sagittarius A star are two primary sources. And though I won't be getting too much into the details of interferometry today, the basic picture here is that every pair of telescopes we have forms an interferometric baseline, which measures a single Fourier coefficient of images on the sky. And so throughout all of the analysis I'm talking about today, keep in mind that we have a sparse sampling of the Fourier transform of these images, and we're trying to make sense of the physics that could give rise to those observations. So if you had asked me in 2017 what the EHT was for, before we had produced any of our images, before we had really gotten into the heart of data analysis, I would have had a very snappy answer for you. It's for taking the first ever pictures of black holes. And by that metric, it was a great success. On the left, this is a picture of Messier 87, and on the right, this is Sagittarius A star. Sagittarius A star has a slightly larger angular size, and in this Messier 87 image, you see these white ticks. You're going to be seeing a lot of those ticks in this talk today. They represent the linear polarization of the light in the neighborhood of the tick on the screen. And in both of these images, we see something very exciting. We see a slightly asymmetric ring of light around a central brightness depression. And that central brightness depression we see as indicative of a black hole. And that's horribly intriguing. It's a great success of engineering and science. And yet those of us on the theory side have the audacity to ask, now what? What are we actually getting out of this in constraining astrophysics and constraining physics? What have we learned about black holes and their history in nature? What, besides a pretty picture, are we learning? And what remains to be learned? So in broad strokes, I would say there's a few things that we've learned that are very specific and a few very general from these observations. On the specific side, we can measure a mass from our images, and we do so in the context of a vast number of general relativistic magnetohydrodynamical simulations. So these GRMHD models are our best representation of what we think black holes in nature look like. We can, emulate the space-time around a black hole. We can draw plasma into it in a way that we think is sensible, and then we can ray trace them at 230 gigahertz to see what we think they might look like. And when we do this ray tracing and then we blur to the EHT resolution, we get blurry rings, much like our observations, and therefore we can build a calibration between the mass that we input into our simulation and the observation, because the mass is just a scaling factor that makes it scales the entire problem in and out. It makes our images larger, increases their diameters. And so by looking at the diameter of this blurry ring, we can get a sense of the mass. And when we do so, we get something consistent with measurements from other methods for both Messier 87 and Sag A star. This is a great sanity check that we're doing something right, both in our simulations and our observation. Moreover, when we add in polarization information for Messier 87, and actually even without this information for Sag A star, we see a preference in our model for dynamically important magnetic fields in the accretion flow. And I'll be getting into accretion zoology a little bit later in the talk. But this is critical for getting the jet right, for launching the powerful jet that we see in Messier 87, and for more generally understanding the accretion history of these sources It looks like they're fairly magnetized. But more generally, this is a triumph of two-temperature GRMHD. They are excellent at producing images which are basically indistinguishable from EHD observations after appropriate blurring. There's always going to be some sort of snapshot of a flow in our library that is the spitting image of our observations. And so at that blurry level, we've done a great job. However, we know our models aren't good enough. We know a priori that for various methodological reasons, we know our plasma treatment is grossly incorrect, and we know that our models are, they have resolution issues and limits and fundamental computational limits on what can be done. And we know even in the context of data that we're doing things horribly wrong. In Sagittarius Star, our models were much too variable. There was this variability crisis in our analysis. And so though they are great at resembling the images, we know that there's much left undone that is all at great computational cost. And so we would believe our conclusions about these sources, our conclusions of their mass, potentially our future conclusions about their spin, our conclusions about their magnetic field structure, much more when simple, ideally universal physical arguments back up these detailed GRMHD comparisons. Because these detailed comparisons aren't going away. They're still our best tool for understanding these sources and what black holes are like in astrophysical contexts. But this cannot form the backbone of our analysis forever. And so my focus throughout all of my graduate work has been on building tools and indeed experiments that connect messy astrophysical measurements to fundamental physical properties. And this applies not just to the current EHT data, but to the next generation EHD, and even to potential spaceborne missions that might be doing VLBI at these frequencies or higher. And to my mind, the most exciting thing we could be doing with all of this infrastructure and all of this simulation work is understanding black hole spin. Why spin? In this image, you see Messier 87 as seen by Hubble. And you can see its jet extending off to the northwest on massive scales, you know, thousands of light years. Spin is a very special parameter in that it has a very simple effect on the black hole spacetime. It's, you know, one of a handful of parameters that specifies all everything you could know about a black hole. And yet it has a very complicated relationship with the history of the black hole, its merger and accretion history, on its feedback with its host galaxy and the intergalactic medium through its jets, and also its interaction with astronomy at large, in the sense that for low luminosity AGN, we basically have no way to produce a reliable measurement of the supermassive black hole spin. The only other game in town besides VLBI is in bright AGN, where you can get some rough constraints from X-rays and sort of X-ray polarimetry, and even those measurements are pretty shaky. And so we're at this unique crossing point where it's this critically important parameter that would inform vast swaths of theory in astronomy, but where we're really the only people who can inform any sort of data constraint on low luminosity AGN spins. And so I see it as a duty to astronomy at large to chase this measurement full force. And so this brings me to the outline of my talk, where I'll be talking about spin constraints and the effect of spin on various observables in the context of three primary topics. The first is the black hole photon ring, which is the sharp ring of light composed of these highly lensed images of the accretion flow that come from increasingly orbiting photon trajectories. I'll be talking about polarization spirals, which are the patterns in the polarization of light that emerge from different magnetic field orientations in the accretion flow. And then lastly, I'll be talking about, slightly more on the algorithmic side, some semi-analytic model fitting codes that I've been working on, which make all of these constraints a little bit more formal and interpretable, and will hopefully provide a powerful complement to the GRMHD analysis that is the standard for the HD as we know it, and which will form the bulk of the first two sections of my talk. I'll be starting, of course, with the photon ring, which can be best understood, I think, with a parallel understanding in two paradigms. in this forwards paradigm on the left, any point in space has an infinite number of light paths connecting to the observer. These paths correspond to increasing numbers of windings around the black hole, here shown in blue and green. In this blue trajectory on the left, the emitter here, this little orange ball, emits a photon in one direction, which half orbits once, and we count this half orbit index n as one, and then makes its way to the observer to the north. And there's another trajectory, which is emitted upwards, which half orbits once, twice, and then makes its way to the observer to the north. And indeed, there are infinite such trajectories, which we could enumerate that way. Meanwhile, on the right, in this backwards paradigm, a point on the observer image corresponds to a single photon path, which might intersect a plane around the black hole any number of times. This is where this disks produce rings idea comes from, which is this, if I just fire a ray back from my eyeball, from my camera, from my telescope, this orbit might just be slightly deflected by the black hole and never intersect a plane of emitters around the black hole ever again, which is this trajectory over here, this n equals zero. But there are also trajectories which are heavily bent by the black hole and then fly around and hit the plane one more time, but then otherwise don't intersect. And so they have support in the n equals zero and n equals one image. And as we approach a surface on the screen called the critical curve, the number of mid-plane intersections of these photons increases. And so the defining property of this critical curve is this exponential stacking of sub-images as we approach it radially inward on the screen. And so what we see when we look at these sources, and it's very apparent in GRMHD, are a sum of lensed images, an infinite sum, where this asterisk is just to scare you about absorption effects, because eventually your highest n images are just completely absorbed. But in principle, for a fully optically thin model, we are seeing an infinite sum of lensed images where the direct image, this n equals zero, this image where we are seeing the shortest path connecting the emitter to the observer, has lots of astrophysical fluff in it. Whereas this n equals one, we see all that same fluff, but it's been radially compressed by lensing by a factor of roughly 20 for a spin zero black hole. And so this compression makes the structure much more simple, much more fine. And fine structure to an interferometer, which is measuring Fourier transforms, is very exciting because it's a way to separate scales. And interferometers are very good at separating scales. N equals two, it gets, once again, a factor of 20 thinner and dimmer. And so it's harder and harder to see. But nominally, all of these images are present at once in the image. And so the photon ring is very exciting if you're interested in constraining theoretical properties of the black hole, physical properties and parameters, because it is an absolute ruler in a problem which otherwise has no intrinsic scale. In principle, if I just had a black hole with a plane of emitters around it, I could heat up, or let's say it's a plane of electrons of uniform density, I could heat up those electrons wherever I want, and I could produce any relation between the mass of the black hole and its apparent ring of brightness size or diameter that I wanted. I could antagonistically try to obscure the true nature of the black hole by painting light in a particular way. But if you're sensitive to this lensed feature, then this approximation of the photon ring that is provided by the n equals one image is giving us a very powerful handle on the mass to distance ratio, which scales this critical curve in and out, the spin, which warps and shifts the critical curve, and the inclination, which bends the photon ring around the line of nodes and sort of squishes it in one axis and extends it in the other. And so sensitivity to the photon ring is terribly exciting because it breaks a number of degeneracies. And we can actually show this rigorously, as I will at the end of the talk, in semi-analytic model fitting scenarios. But why is this worth worrying about? Every EHD image looks like a blurry donut. Why worry about something that is drastically below our beam scale? And the answer is going to involve a little bit of VLBI jargon. On the left, we have a snapshot of a GRMHD simulation in which I have one moment in time decomposed n equals zero and n equals one images. The direct image has lots of fine structure. In fact, comparable fine structure to the n equals one ring, to the degree that the EHT can tell. In particular, when we observe with the EHT, we are essentially probing correlation lengths in the spatial structure of the image. And so the separation of our telescopes is telling us how fine the structure is that we can probe. And for the EHT, this is around 8 gigalambda on our longest baselines in our 2017 coverage at 230 gigahertz. And so at this 8 gigalambda point, the Fourier energy in the n equals 0 image is actually almost identical to the n equals 1. That sharp ring is about as bright to us as the direct image fine structure. And this folds in both the relative brightness of the photon ring with respect to the direct image, as well as the size scales of both. So this might seem like a terrible coincidence, but it turns out almost every simulation in the vast libraries of simulations produced by the EHT has this property, where on our longest baselines, the ratio of power between the direct and indirect image is with, you know, somewhere between a third and a factor of 3. So even if we can't resolve it, even if our images will never unambiguously tell us that, oh, this must be a photon ring here, it means that if you're ever in a semi-analytic modeling scenario, you must worry about this if you're going to get your observation right. And so with that in mind, knowing that this is in our data, just obscured by the n equals zero image, we will move to signatures that will be present in the n equals zero and n equals one in different ways, and we'll begin worrying about them in a model-fitting context. So with that, I will be moving on to polarization spirals, but keep that photon ring in mind. And along the way, I'll be sharing a little bit about how we interpreted Messier 87's polarization. So I'll begin with a little bit of accretion zoology. We typically sort the accretion flows that can explain low luminosity AGN into two bins. There's standard and normal evolution, which have weaker fields that tend to go with the flow and end up generally more disordered in their magnetic fields, but the magnetic fields are overall more toroidal, sort of following a gently inspiraling flow that is mostly turbulence dominated. Whereas in magnetically arrested disks, we have strong, dynamically important magnetic fields threading the event horizon itself. And so in this diagram here from Ramesh Narayan's seminal paper on these, the picture is that the inward ram pressure of the gas is being counterbalanced by the magnetic pressure. And so this leads to more powerful radial and vertical fields in the inner accretion flow where EHT observations are actually probing. And so we'd like to tell these apart because they tell a very different story for the accretion history of the black hole, as well as its ability to power a jet, which is, of course, critical for understanding M87, which has this booming jet. And unfortunately, at the EHT resolution, total intensity images, so images which are just the total light we see in a particular pixel or on the spatial scale, doesn't distinguish these accretion states. In this diagram, I have three models here. This is taken from EHT paper one, where the M87 paper one, where we have three qualitatively different models. We have a SANE with retrograde high spin and relatively cold electrons, which is what this R-high parameter is telling you. We have a zero spin SANE with a relatively low R-high, so fairly hot electrons. And on the right, we have a MAD that's prograde and very highly spinning with also fairly hot electrons. But when you blur all of these to the EHT resolution, they look virtually identical. They're all qualitatively very similar and also similar to our observations. And so we aren't learning much that could tell these apart by observing them with the EHT. But thankfully, we have another handle on the magnetization. If there is some fundamental systematic difference in the magnetic field structure of these sources, that should show up in the polarization of synchrotron radiation, because the synchrotron radiation is polarized perpendicularly to the screen projected magnetic field. And so barring interference from Faraday effects, really, so Faraday rotation primarily of the magnetic field, or excuse me, of the polarization signal, we should just be able to read off the differences between these accretion states. And so that's the motivation for work I did with co-authors George Wong and Ben Prather, looking at libraries of these GRMHD simulations in polarization. So here I've shown a single snapshot. On the left, it's a single snapshot of a MAD, and on the right, it's a single snapshot of a SANE. So on the left, remember MADS, more magnetized, stronger radial and vertical fields. We see that when we blur, which effectively depolarizes all of the fine spatial structure and polarization, we see a nice coherent, rotationally symmetric, spiraling polarization structure. And the same is true of this particular saying, where we see this nice radial polarization structure. And if we recall that this polarization should be perpendicular to the underlying magnetic field structure, this makes sense. If these saints are more sort of toroidal in their magnetic fields, perpendicular to that should look radial when viewed from above. And that really is the geometry of the M87 viewing problem. We have a jet that's roughly inclined around 17 degrees to us. We're basically looking down at a spinning top. And so with that in mind, with this hope that there is some systematic axisymmetric difference in the magnetic field geometry between these MADS and SANES, we should hope for a systematic difference in their rotationally symmetric polarization structure. And so we decompose our polarization into an averaged polar basis, where this is basically an azimuthal Fourier transform, where we have basis functions that encode a different variation with respect to the image azimuthal angle verifying. And we end up with these coefficients, these beta m's, which are, I'm not going to get into the math too much, but it's basically proportional to the fractional polarization, but encodes where the variation, where the structure in the polarization is actually coming from. And so a priori, if we hope that we're tracking something that's axisymmetric in the domain of the black hole, but rotationally symmetric in the domain of the image, we expect these beta 2 parameters, which are rotationally symmetric, to capture most of that structure. And indeed, that will end up being the case. Now, these are complex coefficients, and they encode structure that will be very familiar to you if you are familiar with CMB polarization studies. It's, in fact, identical to EMB mode, or the EMB decomposition of polarization, where the rotational symmetry in the EVPA is encoded by this beta 2 signal or coefficient, and its phase encodes the particular orientation of the spiral. On the top, we have the real mode, where a positive real mode is radial and a negative real mode is circular, and the imaginary component is just giving us the handedness of a spiral. And so intuitively, we would hope that SANES, which have a more toroidal magnetic field structure, would have a correspondingly more radial EVPA, whereas the MADS will be somewhere between a negative real and a handed spiral, where this will depend on the direction of motion of the material and the magnetic field is being dragged along behind it by flux freezing. And so indeed, when we apply this decomposition to images, that is what we see. The M equals 2 mode has a plurality of the Fourier energy. And we blur it to HD resolution. This will depolarize the image. It will knock out some of the higher M modes, these higher spatial frequencies. But at the level of the blurring that we're doing, it doesn't really affect the M equals 2 mode very much at all, which is great news. And so we apply this decomposition to every model in this 72,000 image library. And on top of it, we've plotted here this little gray circle. And this gray circle is a set of constraints from EHD images of M87. We find that M87 has this gently circular but slightly spiraling polarization structure. And this position in the complex plane of beta 2 is actually very special because it is inconsistent with a very large number of SANES, particularly retrograde SANES, which are otherwise very good at mimicking every other metric we have, polarized or otherwise, for M87. And so this quantitative measure of the rotational structure and polarization is critically important for disfavoring SANES and favoring MADS instead. And so this all hinges upon the fact that we think we understand our rotation measure. We think that the Faraday rotation of our polarization is low. But all in all, it's a great result because MADS have lots of wonderful properties that I'll get into later in the talk. But it's very exciting. This is the core result of paper 8, and it just relies on this decomposition that I proposed that gives us the sensitivity to the axisymmetric magnetic field structure. But what's much more exciting is a different signature, which is apparent in this left plot. In the green here, I have zero spin models, which are predominantly MADS. Mads and Saints are binned together here, but this fan structure in the bottom two quadrants is predominantly Mads once you're away from the origin. Spin minus 0.5 here in yellow, spin of 0.5 here in blue, spin of retrograde 0.94, and spin of prograde 0.94 here in the black and pink. As we move from the negative imaginary axis, which you'll recall is a circular polarization and therefore a radial magnetic field, as we move through the bottom two quadrants over to the positive real direction, which you'll recall is a radial polarization pattern and therefore a toroidal magnetic field, we are increasing in the magnitude of spin. Why might that be happening? This is coming from frame dragging, because in these mats, they light up very close to the horizon. Most of the light, in fact, is coming from within the ergosphere. And so what that means is that the motion of the material is mostly being set by the black hole, and in fact, by the black hole spin. And the more rapidly that it's rotating, the more toroidal motion of the material very close to the horizon. And because of flux freezing, it's dragging the magnetic field behind it. And so for models that are very rapidly spinning, and in all of these black holes, in this image, the black hole is rotating clockwise. So as it rotates very rapidly, the material very close to it is dragged into toroidal motion, the magnetic field is toroidal, the polarization looks radial. Whereas in the zero spin model, where the material's falling almost directly radially onto the black hole, the magnetic field behind it is therefore radial, and so we end up with a circular polarization. So this is an extremely powerful sort of smoking gun for frame dragging, but it requires a very special property, which is the property of MADS that they're lighting up within their ergosphere. And so this is one of many points in our understanding of these sources where the accretion physics, the detailed sort of electron heating, is a critical assumption for something that's very exciting and potentially universal. And so the trust that the community has in the heating of the electrons in these MADS, I think, will be a major determinant of our ability to extract spin from what I would call large-scale blurry features in the coming years. But this is, you know, sort of pontificating. There's one thing I want to point out here. In this retrograde high-spin model, the inner accretion flow has the same handedness as the prograde models over here. But as you move out in radius, you actually see it turn around. If you follow the EVPA ticks, it forms a sort of S curve, which is one can train the eye to look for it. But the picture here is that all of these black holes are spinning clockwise. But if they're retrograde, which we show with this minus sign in the spin, then on large scales, they're actually the materials rotating counterclockwise. Large scale accretion flows counter rotating with respect to the black hole. So we're seeing the turnover in the fluid motion, in the phase of the polarization. And you can actually see this in snapshots, and there's a beautiful paper by Angelo Ricarte, myself and others, which goes through this in detail. But this is something that will be apparent at high dynamic range. So the EHT can't see it, but we'll be able to see it with a little bit better Fourier coverage, which frankly, I think might happen in like 2022. And this is very exciting to happen soon, but it's a way to find out definitively whether we're seeing counter rotation across scales.
Sorry, did you say 2022?
Yes, and this is just coming let me rephrase. The data might be observed as early as 2022 or soon thereafter. When it's published, God knows when. What I would say is,
I guess I'm getting a hang in it. We're already in 2023.
I'm sorry?
Aren't we in 2023?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. my brain is elsewhere. Yeah, I'm mostly referring to when the data is actually observed. And so the short baseline coverage that we have from sites that are, I believe, are fully functional as of 2022 should be sort of good enough once we start to look at it. But I guess 2022 observations were a little iffy. My point is that this is not 10 years in the future. This is a 230 gigahertz observable that just requires high spatial dynamic range. And so this isn't a 2030 array that needs to get this together. You just need short baselines to get this high dynamic range structure. The specific year is sort of irrelevant here. I'm ambitious that we'll have results on this out by 2025. Now, there's a signature here that I want to...
Do you mind if I ask you a question on the previous slide?
Sure, sure.
Yes, so for the slide on the right where you have this number of images and you're trying to rule out certain models based on this beta 2 parameter. So if I understood correctly, this is just some library of MHD simulations. And
that's
you
right.
Were saying, for the particular parameters that were chosen for this same retrograde model, there are only a couple of them that satisfy the observational constraint. So I was wondering sort of how much we should read into that. Is that just saying that for the parameters that are chosen to make these images, there are not that many that satisfy them? Or is that some statement about, these simulations are turbulent and if you take different snapshots, you can get different results, but most of the time they're not in some state where you get these observations.
That's a very good question. So yeah, it's a continual fear that we haven't checked the GRMHD thoroughly enough, that we're missing some fraction of what's possible that might be a nature that we haven't realized. I think in this case, our library basically has sort of four parameters. There's mass, spin, inclination, and R-high. And there's other sort of second order things that we fit to match the total flux of what we observe. And the thing that's arguably the most important in setting agreement with all of our other metrics besides beta 2 is this R high. It's how hot or cold are the electrons. And our search of that parameter is basically already breaking the limits of what's physically reasonable to do with post-processing of the EDF. As is currently standard in the field. And I think there's a great number of people who work on the problem of post-processing plasma and GRMHD simulations that all believe that we're doing it horribly wrong. And the next, we should be sensitive, not just to plasma beta, but to plasma sigma, and we need more knobs. And so at that level, I could believe that anything that's probing fractional polarization might actually be way off and that we're painting cold electrons in all the wrong places. And so, this is something where I hope that over the next few years, as these plasma post-processing improves, we'll get a better sense of this. But at the moment, up to this R-high prescription and different spins and so on, we think we're doing a pretty good job. These models are definitely acquiescence. We're looking at them for 2,000 or 4,000 M in some cases, which is years and years of evolution. So at that level, I think we're basically at the limit of the post-processing, and once that improves, we can check again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but so I was also wondering though, so if I'm reading this plot correctly, there are a few of the, like, for example, same retrograde models that are consistent with the HD range, is that right?
That's right. So for this particular metric, that's correct.
And basically my question is, what should we read into the fact that there are a small number, like, is that because for these images, are they sort of uniform over the different physical parameters like mass and spin? So this is just saying that there's only a few mass ranges of mass and spin where you get a consistent result? Or what should we read?
I see. Yeah, so just to be a little more clear, so each pair of, or each set of mass, spin, and electron distribution function produces 200 images in this library per inclination. And we also, we try a little band of inclinations around 17 degrees. We do plus or minus 5 there. And so what this is saying is that in a set of, for example, 200 images, there might be 5 or 10 from a particular model that happen to instantaneously match the beta 2 phase, but in general don't. And I think that's fair to say of virtually all of these sayings, is that in general, they might wander into the right regime, but then they wander back out for most of the time.
Yeah, thanks.
Great. Cool. I will move on for now. So there's a mental exercise I want you to engage in the context of these rings. Take this diagram, which I showed you earlier, and I want you to imagine flipping this upside down and looking at it from the back. What happens to these rings of EVPA, or electric vector position angle ticks, when you do this operation, when you flip east and west? the radial stays radial, the circular stays circular, but the handed spirals swap in place. This is a complex conjugation of beta 2. And what I will argue is that this is a decent analogy for what the photon ring sees, because the photon ring is composed of photons which were emitted backwards and then make their way around the black hole and come to the observer. Now, in detail, this is more like a reflection through the origin than a flip. And in even greater detail, this is actually a symmetry of polarized parallel transport, which is a symmetry of the Penrose-Walker constant. But by and large, this is effectively what a disk of polarized emission is going to look like in its indirect image, its first indirect image, that n equals 1. And so one might expect to see some funky behavior in polarization near the photon ring, and indeed you do. In sands, and in this case, this is a high spin sane with perfectly thermalized protons and electrons. These are very hot electrons. We are looking at a model which has nearly perfectly radial polarization, and therefore a photon ring that also has nearly radial polarization, and these will constructively interfere. This gray outline is just saying that in the profiles of polarization, the sum exceeds any individual sub-image. Whereas in spiraling images, which the vast majority of magnetically arrested disks are, we see destructive interference. We get these bands of these dark bands of depolarization, where the n equals 1 is partially canceling with the n equals 0. Now, this is not something that's readily observable in blurry images. You might see a slight dip, but it's hard to associate it directly with the photon ring. But it's something to keep in mind for the interferometry of the future, and more generally as a potent signature of spin, because the exact relation between the direct and indirect image is this. It's given up basically completely by the Penrose-Walker constant associated with the ray. And that's a joint constraint on the magnetic field in the sort of emitting patch, but also the spin. And so what I would say here is that the interferometry of the future, so either 690 gigahertz interferometry from the ground or space-based interferometry or really anything that has any expectation of constraining the photon ring, so I would say lengthy observation at 230, even from the ground with EHT, should see a constraint on photon ring polarization that can be associated with the direct image and therefore put a joint constraint on these delicate parameters of the emitting region, the magnetic field, and the spin. But no one can be measured without the other. And with that in mind, with these degeneracies in mind, I will move to my final topic. And I realize I only have like 10 minutes left, so I'll try to stick to time, which is semi-analytic modeling, where enough with all of these complicated image domain metrics on GRMHD, just fit the accretion system. And the motivation here, you know, just looking at this bottom right image of Sagittarius star, is that there's nothing intrinsic about this image which tells you the mass of the black hole. You have to know where things are lighting up to know the mass of the system. And so if we're going to have a measurement of the mass that's dependent on something like where things are glowing, where things are glowing ought to be a model parameter that you fit in a formal framework. And so the hope here is that with all of these fundamental degeneracies between where things are lighting up and whether your brightness is sourced by, you know, stronger magnetic fields or number density or rather Doppler or whatever, all of these should be fit in parallel. And so my answer for doing this the right way is called Kerr Bayesian accretion modeling, or Kerbam, as I will force everyone to call it. And in this model, I make a number of assumptions. It's a one zone model effectively for optical depth and velocity and magnetic field that I make axisymmetric, and a purely equatorial emission geometry, which it turns out is a huge assumption for sanes. And I've aligned my disk and my black hole spin. So there's no funky disk tilt here. And it's all just power law electrons, very simple spectral character. And I'm only going to be fitting Stokes' eye in all of the fits I'm showing you, though the model does predict polarization that will indeed be critical for backing out all of these polarized signatures. And the result is hopefully trustworthy or at the very least interpretable posteriors on black hole parameters in a few hours on a personal computer. This is all very optimized code that I think is sort of competitively fast with other models like it in the sort of RIAF family. And so in detail, on the left, this is the top-down view where I'm fitting an axisymmetric fluid velocity, this beta, where it's oriented in an axisymmetric sense by this angle chi. You don't need to know the details here, but crucially, I let the user specify any emissivity function they want. I typically use this double-sided power law just because it's a decent match for GRMHD and it's fairly general. But really what's important here is that you can paint light wherever you want, and you can rotate your fluid however you want, and you can paint in whatever magnetic field you want as long as it's axisymmetric. So this is built for fitting quiescent flows. On the right, I have what I consider system viewing parameters. We have the angular size of the gravitational radius, theta g, which scales the whole problem in and out. I have the spin of the black hole, which is, of course, you know, torquing the space-time. I have the position angle of the projected spin axis, which is just an image rotation. And I have the viewing inclination, which is going to tilt the whole system. And together, these two specify however many sub-images I want. And the ability to terminate those geodesics wherever I want is actually critical for disentangling different kinds of effects and for making very clear where my sensitivity to, for example, mass or spin is actually coming from. So pedagogically, before we even do any fitting, this is already useful. In this plot, I'm going to show you the n equals 0 and n equals 1 image from a model that's at 45 degrees and has otherwise fairly reasonable parameters. And you can break down quantities which the resulting image is just a product of. So the resulting image is a product of each of these panels moving left to right. The synchrotron emissivity, the combined redshift, so this is Doppler and gravitational. The emission profile, which again is just some function which I dictate, some function of r and phi, in this case just r, because I've chosen to run it axisymmetrically here. And also the optical path length. In this case, I'm choosing an optically thin, like a perfectly optically thin model, so the brightness is just proportional to the path length. There is also an optical depth recently added. And then the sub-image, we see very different structures. And I think most interestingly that the path length, of course, explodes in these glancing angles, which are just barely bent back into hitting the midplane. And so you get this sort of explosion of path length at the very outer edges of the photon ring. But this is useful for telling us where image structures are coming from. And indeed, when you sum these and then blur them to EHD resolution, it may well be the case that your photon ring is actually dictating an important part of the structure of your image. And so just as one simple example fit of the model to itself, here I'm using EHT 2017 M87 coverage, so not actual data, but using this coverage to sample the model, where in one case, I've chopped out the photon ring. So I'm only seeing weak lensing, I'm only seeing the direct image, and I'm fitting a model that also has only the direct image to itself. And as I claimed earlier, there is no intrinsic notion of the scale of the problem. I see in red here a perfect degeneracy between the emission radius r and this mass proportional quantity theta g, this long band. Whereas when I add in the photon ring, even with the EHT 2017 data, I now have an absolute sensitivity to the position of the angular size and therefore the physical size of the system, because this photon ring is providing this absolute ruler. However, even with the photon ring, I do not gain sensitivity to spin. However, we have a better test than fitting the model to itself. We have GRMHD. But these GRMHD are messy, and we know that they aren't thin disks. The model itself is an optically thin, geometrically thin disk, which is already sort of wacky in the context of these flows. But we know that GRMHD, particularly the stains with cold electrons, produce these funnel wings, which are very poorly approximated by a thin disk. And so there's two questions you have. One, am I even capable of producing images that resemble these models? And two, if I am capable of that and I do such a fit, how will I be biased in what I infer? If I didn't know that stains could produce this kind of emissivity distribution, how would I be wrong in my inferred mass and spin? How would I be misled? And so the first takeaway in doing a fit, not of EHT data, but just an image domain cross-correlation fit of just hunting for the most similar image I can produce, is that this model, this thin disk, is extraordinarily good at mimicking the appearance of time-averaged GRMHD, where they're quiescent, they're axisymmetric, so we're not violating too many assumptions of the model construction, and we end up with beautiful images, which are actually doing a decent job of getting not just the image, but the underlying physical parameters correct. And what's miraculous is that this is also true in SANES, but only for the purposes of matching the image. In these SANES, where I know it's going horribly wrong, where I know the model is highly misspecified, in the vast majority of cases, I'm able to perfectly mimic the image while getting all of the underlying physical parameters wrong, horribly wrong. And so what this should tell you is that if you're going to back out anything fundamental, anything physical from an image, you need to be extraordinarily cautious that your model is appropriately general, because changes in the emission geometry can drastically alter the relation between an image and its underlying physical parameter. Now, with all of those caveats in your head, I now feel morally allowed to show you some rather forward-looking results on MID7. These are unpublished, these are very preliminary, but given that MID7 is leaning MAD, and in MADs we tend to get the underlying parameters right, we can, with bold hearts, you know, fools rush in, fit the model to MID7, and this time drop in a little bit of optical depth, give the model some absorption, give it a way to turn off the photon ring if it wants to. And what we find is something very exciting, which is that we get a threefold or sort of trimodal posterior, which is arguably the most politically correct posterior you could ever publish on MID7, because it has support for every previously published mass constraint on MID7, where this Walsh 2013 result, this gas dynamical measurement, has some support, but only if the optical depth is high and the photon ring is gone. When the optical depth is low and this photon ring is present and it's contributing its own radial and azimuthal structure, we see a preference for the higher mass estimate that's coming from EHT and also from stellar dynamical measurements. So what that means is that some other prior needs to inform you here. In this case, the GRMHD prior is telling us, oh, well, these are mostly optically thin, so we should maybe lean towards the higher end of this mass posterior. But this exploration, this fairly complicated joint constraint, we can get this in a few hours on a dinky little laptop. And so that, in my opinion, is the value of these semi-analytic models, is that they can break assumptions that are baked into GRMHD at a 1/10,000th of the computational cost. So I'm at time, I'm going to wrap up. More general classes of models are on the horizon. My wonderful colleague, Dominic Chang, is currently working on extending Kerbam to include arbitrarily tilted cones, so lifting this disk off of the horizon to model jet structures. Of course, more fits of Kerbam to MID7 and SAGIS are on the way. Since they're both leaning MAD, the big issue is quiescence. They are likely not azimuthally symmetric, which is breaking a model assumption. And also, though I didn't have time for today, I am very excited about using these polarization quantities in these images of black holes where the shadow is resolved to try and back out spin when they are not resolved. And the argument here is just this animation showing that you can actually back out this spiral property even when you have not resolved the shadow, but you at least get some diffuse sense of the spiral. And indeed, model fitting results and some papers by Dominic Pesci and myself seem to corroborate this, that if you're willing to make extraordinarily strong assumptions, you can get spin before you get mass, which is a horrifying conclusion to consider. So just to end there, I think my broad pronouncement is that the future of data analysis on EHT and NGHT lies in informative priors. It lies in assuming that GR is correct at the scales that we're probing and seeing what we can tell about the magnetic field and the velocities and the distribution of emissivities. And in general, being willing to make stronger statements about what we believe to probably be true and then make formal statements in the context of those assumptions. And with that, I will take questions. Thank you.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah, sure. Hi, thanks for talking. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. So can you repeat for this Kerbam model that you were explaining, what are the assumptions of this emission model that you put there? I didn't fully understand if what kind of like physical assumptions you had into the fit, or it was completely unconstrained.
Yeah, sorry, that is, you're very much forgiven. I had zoomed through this because I realized I was going long. So the assumptions are basically that the fluid velocity in the zero angular momentum observer frame is constant in azimuthal angle, and in this case also radius, as is the magnetic field orientation and the magnetic field strength, up to an overall sort of emissivity envelope, which is itself axisymmetric. I think the easiest way to think about this, if you happen to be familiar with these radiatively inefficient accretion flow models, is that it is a compressed RIAF. We've compressed a RIAF to the plane to make ray tracing and radiative transfer faster by roughly a factor of 1,000, and otherwise it proceeds identically, except for this radially invariant fluid velocity and magnetic field. So mostly the big assumption is it's in a plane. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
Can I follow up a little bit of related question? So there is a lot of things in the ingredients that go into then trying to get an answer out that go from the gravity. Let's say gravity, if there's anything that is nailed down pretty strongly now, thanks to the gravitational waves, is the metric. Of course, you can say, well, maybe at a different scale of masses, it might be different. But okay, yeah, I can also hope that tomorrow I'm going to win the lottery. But the accretion disk has a lot of different models to it. The emission and the characteristics of it as well. So, I mean, you pointed out at the end exactly the need for informative priors, but what will it take to have them? Will the EHT ever, given the status of affairs, have something that would be sharp? Or is it that we just have to live with qualitative features and that's the best we could do?
Yeah, so that is the question of the era, in my opinion. That question will sink, will sort of sail or sink the entire EHT project. And my hope and my personal opinion from my work is that the EHT is telling us something deep and important about the accretion physics, and it will tell us that far earlier than it will ever tell us anything about sort of deviations from Kerr. And I think particularly in the context of improvements in dynamic range and the sort of continual observation of M87 that will come from the sort of vastly expanded NGHT, where we will be able to watch in detail, and just every 3 days we will have a snapshot of M87 watching material fall in, be launched into the jet, that will really break degeneracies in what's glowing, where, and what its magnetic field geometry really are. And the sort of holy grail at the end of that is the connection between magnetic field strength and geometry, black hole spin, and jet launching through the Blanford's Snag mechanism. And that's something you can't get at with any other means than sort of attacking the accretion flow directly with polarized observations. So I see that as the big, exciting result of the impending EHT and NGHT. And it can't really be done unless you're willing to assume GR is doing something right. I completely agree with your line of questioning, and it's something we on the sort of theory side of the EHT need to reckon with.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I guess to follow with Louis' question, right? Like from an observational point of view, right? Like, I mean, maybe EHT you can get some kind of a spin measurement or constraint for supermassive black hole. Is it possible to find a system that you can also measure the spin with other means, and then as example to test this EHT approach of measuring spins, right? Like, is it going to be ever possible?
Yeah. So having multiple constraints on spin from just the EHT is pretty tough. The only way I've seen it posed that I find believable at all would involve multi-frequency phase transfer from 86 to 230 to 345, where you get some sense of spin from polarization, And ideally, with this high dynamic range, you would get some notion of whether it's retrograde or prograde, and also its magnitude from frame dragging near the center. Then from multi-frequency phase transfer, you get relative astrometry between 86, 230, and 345. And that is also a tracer of spin, because at higher frequencies, you're more optically thin. The relative brightness of the photon ring goes up, and the photon ring shifts relative to the 86 gigahertz emission in a way that is directly proportional to spin. And so in that sense, there is a set of joint constraints you can get. And then another layer to this is, if you think you are increasingly sensitive to the photon ring at higher frequencies, then you can do some sort of relative emission location matching. And your own Avery Broderick has done a tremendous amount of wonderful work on this topic to get a sort of third constraint on spin that way. And if they all gave the same answer, that would be tremendously exciting. And my own sort of private bet from my own fits to M87 and from, I think, some other work is it's leaning towards being prograde-ly spinning to some relatively high degree, but probably not maximally. But yeah, I'm hopeful that we will have more than one way to pitch spin. And I guess the weakest, in the sense that it relies on strongest assumptions, is this GRMHD spiral of polarization. But if that ends up being true, and M87 is the only test bed we have to see if that works, then that opens up the sky to us to find spin in 100 other places.
I mean, I'm just thinking about, right, like in the future, let's say with Spanish waves, you could maybe observe this, stellar mass object orbiting around these supermass bubbles. These gravitational waves may tell us about the spin of the larger black hole with really high precision, for example, and maybe sometimes you might find, like stars going around these large black holes with relatively close orbit, or neutron stars. Maybe that can be used as another way of measuring spin as well. So,
In the broad scheme of measuring spins of black holes across mass scales and across sort of accretion parameters and across AGN categories, the EHT is only a small piece, and there's a large number of sources that it will never be able to touch just because they're too far away or they're too small, where we need methods beyond the EHT to understand them. I think the reason why I'm excited about spin in the particular context of the EHT is that these other methods will never target the spin of low luminosity AGN any sort of census level number that we would need to actually understand our local universe. That said, in the broad tapestry of understanding spin and sort of black hole space times and other regimes, absolutely you need other methods. Yeah.
Well, if it's like Emery, right? If it's an extreme mass ratio in spiral, this can measure spin super well, and that super the accretion flow could be. And low luminosity of AGN as well. I mean, I'm not sure if EHT will be able to resolve it.
I think that the probability of that happening in an EHT target where we have a hope of seeing spin is maybe a little low, but sometimes you're lucky and nature shows you things that you really don't deserve to have a chance of seeing. So that'd be great.
Maybe a related question. So you focused in your talk on M87. What about measuring the spin of Sagittarius A star? I guess maybe these models are not as relevant there because it's not expected to be mad accretion, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so my thoughts are basically, one does not expect Sag A star to be inclined face on to you. And so a lot of these tools only work for near face on. That said, the EHT observations of Sag A star suggest that its inclination is something like 30 or 40 degrees, and it's basically also consistent with the gravity results, where they saw a face-on, probably mad hotspot evolution that was within 10 or 20 degrees of face-on, let's put it that way. And so if there is this conspiracy of nature where our two largest supermassive black hole targets are both pointed right at us, we don't really have to do much work to have new tools to analyze the spin. That said, I think there are other tools that might be easier, or at least there's a broader retinue of tools that can corroborate a polarization spin measurement for such a star that come from its dynamic. You know, dynamics are highly sensitive to spin, where it's a factor of nearly 10 in the ISCO period. It's a major difference in, the photon ring autocorrelation timescale. My colleague Shahar Hadar has done a wonderful work on that, as has George Wong and I guess Paul Chesler. You know, the sort of dynamical signatures of the time it takes light to make it around the black hole in a spinning case. That's observable for Sagittarius star on a minute-to-minute time scale in a way it isn't for Messier 87. So I'm much more excited about dynamical signatures of spin for Sagittarius star, but they're also much harder to make sense of in VLBI data.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank Daniel again for the very nice talk.
Thank you all for having me. This was very fun.